No, that's right. I was going to have you read it, but I'll read it.
When we had come to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. After greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified God, and they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed? They are all zealous for the law, and they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. Thus all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but that you yourself also live in observance of the law. But as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment that they should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols and from blood and from what has been strangled and from sexual immorality." Then Paul took the men, and the next day he purified himself along with them and went into the temple, giving notice when the days of purification would be fulfilled and the offering presented for each one of them.
I'll have to worry about that strap later. So, Acts chapter 21, verses 17 through the end of that section, which goes all the way to 26. As I thought about this passage, this actually is a passage that's sort of key, one of the key passages that I think of in terms of my understanding of a major theme that runs through Scripture, but especially through the New Testament and the teaching of Jesus. And I'm starting to learn that I can't just rely on the fact that all of you know what that is. I've taught it over and over and over again for years, but many of you still have, you've come so recently that you wouldn't actually know what I'm talking about. And it really, it goes, I just want to set a principle out for you because this passage is related to it. It is the principle and understanding of the word authority and headship and submission. I'll just say it this way. Jesus said in Mark's gospel, he told the disciples that the world doesn't understand the meaning of the word authority and headship. They have it completely wrong. Actually, once Jesus gets done explaining it, you realize it's not just completely wrong, it's completely the opposite of God's understanding of those words. And in 2,000 years, we have not advanced very far, either in this world or in the church. We continue, just as the disciples did in Jesus' day, to define that word as the world does and not as God does. And so consequently, just as the disciples did, we are clamoring all of the time to gain a kind of authority that God says, guys, that's not what this is about. That's how the world understands authority. That's how the world understands submission. That's not how I understand it. That's not what I mean by it. And so consequently, we haven't really advanced very far since the first disciples were arguing with one another on who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom of God. And by that they meant who was going to rule over everyone else and tell them what to do. Because that's how we define the word authority. Authority means I'm in charge. I tell you what to do. Submission means you do what I tell you. That is as foreign of a definition to authority from God's perspective as you can get. It is as opposite as you can get. So Jesus comes along in Mark chapter 10, and he lets us know how it is to be defined. Authority is having the responsibility to serve. The person in the highest authority serves everyone under him in that authority. So husbands, you have been placed in the highest authority in your family. That doesn't mean you get to tell them what to do. and that they have to listen to you. That means your job is to serve them and their needs and interests. You are their servant, which is why in the incarnation, Jesus leaves the throne room of God and comes down and takes on the form of a servant. He never, in doing so, does he relinquish his authority. In fact, his very role as a servant to all of humankind is a demonstration of his divine authority. It's how he demonstrates authority, is he puts their interest above his own. Jesus demonstrated his authority when he went to a cross and let this world crucify him, because he did so knowing that it was in our best interest to reconcile us to his Father. This was his great act of authority. The only submission that's going on in that act is Jesus' submission to the Father, who has asked of Jesus to join him in his character in this demonstration of love. Because ultimately, God's the highest authority. He serves even Christ. The Father, I should say. God the Father serves God the Son because he is the ultimate authority. Now, I've taught this many times, and if you want to know how this applies specifically to a marriage relationship, you should go back and listen to the series in Ephesians on chapter 5, somewhere around 15 through 6, 4, 5, because I think I spent almost 8 or 9 sermons developing what that would look like in a marriage relationship. Because in the end, I would argue, it looks almost the opposite of what we, even in the church, are teaching. Because we have bought into a lie of Satan. In fact, it's his first lie. That authority means, I'm the boss, I'm in charge, and you obey me. See, that's exactly why Satan fell. Because you see, Satan was given a great amount of authority. And then God gave him his job. Your job, Satan, is to go down to the Garden of Eden and be the guardian cherub of Adam and Eve, these lowly creatures that I just made. And your job is to serve them. And Satan was like, you got to be kidding me. I am the most powerful being God has ever made. I live in glorious light. The distance between me, the archangel, and those puny little humans that he just stuck in that garden is so vast and so great. Why in the world would I serve them? They should serve me. And that is exactly what Satan thought, and that is exactly why he fell, because he took God's economy of authority and headship and submission, and he flipped it. And in flipping it, he sold a lie to this world that they have believed ever since. And it's one of our jobs as Christians is to constantly correct it. Because just like the disciples, even when Jesus corrected it for them more than once, over and over, it was so simple for them to fall back into living their lives as if the world was right about this subject. And so Jesus comes in Mark chapter 10 and verse 45, and he lays it out for them in a context where he's talking about authority. And he says, look it, the Son of Man did not come to be served. Authority does not mean that others serve you. Headship does not mean that. It means the Son of Man came to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Not shockingly, husbands, in Ephesians chapter 5 at the end there, Paul turns to the husbands when he's talking about their headship, and what does he tell them? How do you demonstrate this headship? How do you demonstrate this authority? You demonstrate it by being willing to lay down your life for your wife as Christ laid down his life for the church. Because that act on the cross was the greatest demonstration of the authority that God has given his Son, and by extension, given husbands and fathers of families, rulers and kings. There is no such thing as a king who is exercising genuine divine authority who is not a servant to his people. If he is an autocrat that thinks they should serve his wishes and desires, that king is following the model of Satan, not the model of God. And so what does it have to do with this passage? Well, it has something to do with Christmas, for one. It has to do with, we see that Jesus comes to become a servant. He's willing to lay aside everything in order to exercise this authority. So what's it look like? Well, he's willing to serve us at all costs for our best interest. And what is our best interest? Whatever it takes to reconcile us with the Father. That's our best interest. And he's willing to do whatever it takes. As we come to this passage, and we brought it up last week, Paul is demonstrating this Christ-like authority. He is willing to do whatever it takes to bring about reconciliation. He is standing with Christ's model as, my purpose and intent is to bring peace. Now, Paul sees a dilemma, and he's not the only one. Throughout the church at this point, people were seeing a dilemma. It appeared as if two churches were forming, a Jewish Christian church and a Gentile Christian church, and that these two churches were going to part ways and become two different churches. And much of Paul's letters, almost all of his letters, address the issue. And when you know that in the back of your mind, you will read some of those passages differently. There is one faith, one baptism, one Lord. Paul is saying all that in the context of, guys, there is one church. We cannot divide into two churches. We worship the same Lord. We are saved by the same gospel. There's only one gospel. And so Paul is absolutely concerned with maintaining unity in this church. And he comes to Jerusalem with this in mind. He comes on a mission to cement that relationship. He wants to make sure that he has done nothing that might bring a division in the one church. So he comes with an offering from all of the Gentile churches. And remember, the Gentile churches are not just Gentile. They're just in Gentile lands. The Gentile churches often have large groups of Jewish people in them. What they really are Jews and Gentiles worshiping together in these Gentile cities. And here is the dilemma, and this will come in today's passage. The Jewish church in Jerusalem in particular would have almost no Gentiles in it. So that particular church functions very much like a monolithic Jewish church. Because of that, they can hold up Jewish culture in ways that a church that is not monolithic, that has various cultures coming together, they don't have to accommodate those things, and they haven't accommodated them. And so consequently, that's one of the things that's causing these two churches to grow apart. It's not that they believe a different gospel. It's not theology that's driving them apart. It's culture that's driving them apart. Guys, the same thing happens today. Let me just go back, and you know, we could go back 150 years, and it's amazing that it continues today. There's no real reason for it. We often say in America, the most segregated hour of the week in America is Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Why is that? What are they referring to? They're referring to the fact that we have churches that are entirely African American and churches that are entirely white. And they literally can be not just in the same town, but in the same, you know, block. And yet they are completely separate. Why is that? Because we've allowed cultural things to keep us apart. Now, some people come along and say, well, that's good, Tom. You know, culture is good. It is good. It is good. And we might say, you know, I'm comfortable with this culture, so I'm gonna worship in this cultural context. And I'm comfortable with this culture, so I'm gonna worship in this cultural context, and never the twain shall meet. That is not good. That is not what God intended. Here's what God intended. And I think he would say it here with Paul, with the Jewish church and the Gentile church, as much as he would say it in America for the last 150 years with the African-American church and the white evangelical church. He would say, that's not what I'm shooting for. What I'm shooting for is you come together and worship together and that you each respect and accommodate one another's culture. So that in that one service, not one of those cultures is going to dominate over the other. And of course, in our country, it really gets tricky because we're the first country this ever happened to. Guys, just go to Anaconda. My gosh, it's a little more than Deer Lodge, but Anaconda must have 15 different cultures in it. And they're all coming from different ways of worshiping God. We're doing a Ulata service. Why? Because it's a Swedish Baptist church. My goodness, they sing some of the hymns in Swedish. You know what? I don't know Swedish, but I play that hymn and I do my best because that's part of their culture. I'm not going to ask them to let go of that culture. They've been celebrating Christmas that way. I remember when I first came to Anaconda, and I'd never heard of Ulata service. And back then, they were stronger, more committed Swedish Baptists. That service was at 6 o'clock in the morning. Remember, Kay? 6 in the morning. And I remember when they told me that, I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. You think I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning for a church service on Christmas Day while it's still dark? And of course, here in Montana, it almost seemed like every year there was a blizzard. We would have 2 or 3 feet of snow that we're driving through unplowed streets to get to a service at 6 in the morning. That was inconceivable to me. It was not a part of my culture. It wasn't a part of my kids' culture. And they had the same reaction. They were quicker than I was, though. Very quickly, as you know what, hey, I'm sorry, this is my job. This is this church. This is what they do. I need to adapt. And we started doing that. And my kids love that service. So much so that, guys, I've been here for how long now? 13 years. I don't have to celebrate Ulata. It's no longer my job. In the 13 years that I've been here, I've missed one Ulata service. Because that became a part of what we do as a family. And I think God is thinking this way. This is his goal. He wants to see these churches come together and not use culture to separate them, but also not to abandon and ignore cultural things. That we come together in one church and recognize that God is worshiped in many different ways, and we need to regard it and respect it and learn from it and learn to appreciate it, and we will find that our faith and our traditions are enriched. And this is what's happening with Paul. He comes to Jerusalem, and he's coming to a church that has some pretty strong cultural traditions. And he has to figure out a way to maintain unity. So let's read a little bit and we'll see what the problem is. And this is a passage that I have said for years I need to write an article about because I can't find anyone that has my view, but I'm confident that I'm right. And so I need to put it out there so it can be critiqued to see whether or not I really am right. But let's read a little bit here. And so in verse 17, he says, when we had come to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. On the following day, first of all, Luke wants us to know, okay, there's tension in the air, but when Paul shows up, the Spirit of God is already at work. He's already working in the hearts of people because the brothers received them gladly. And that's such an encouragement to Paul because I don't think he was expecting such a reception. And on the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. This must have warmed Paul's heart, and this is going to come back to play, something that we just have to know, that we often don't know. Paul went in with us to James. Who is the us? Well, us certainly includes Luke. Who else does it include? All of Paul's traveling companions. Notice, Luke does not use his normal wording. His normal wording would have been this, and we all went in with Paul to see James. He doesn't use that phrase. He says, Paul went in with us to see James. Who's the meeting between? It appears that it is not between James and Paul. it appears it's between James and this group of Gentile traveling partners of Paul, Luke included, and Aristarchus and Gaius and several other people from these various Gentile churches. But why is this, why would this have warmed Paul's heart? Well, let me give you one reason that we read right over and don't even think about. It is Pentecost. They are going to be celebrating Pentecost this week. Where do you celebrate Pentecost? At the temple. Okay, I'm not following you, Tom. I'm not getting the problem. Luke, or I should say James, and the elders of the church just invited a group of Gentile men into their home to meet with them. Is it starting to click? Do you remember when Jesus was crucified and the Sanhedrin took Jesus to Pilate's house and they wanted Pilate to try him, and they took Jesus and they went right to the steps of Pilate's house and they stopped right there. Why did they stop right there? Because they knew that if they crossed into a Gentile house or brought a Gentile into their home, they would be declared unclean and they would not have been able to celebrate the Passover. You cannot either enter into a Gentile house or bring Gentiles into your own home without affecting your, what they would say, your cleanliness or your ability to come into the presence of God or draw near to the presence of God in the temple. The fact that James and the elders of the church had invited not Paul, but the Gentiles of this church to come in and meet with them, told Paul, these guys are with me. They're with me and not against me. These guys understand. They understand what Christ has done. He has broken down the wall between us. We cannot continue to pretend that a Gentile's presence in our home or our presence in theirs, and especially eating together from at the same meal, can make one of us unclean or not unclean. James understood that. And he wanted Paul to understand that he understood it. So he did not invite Paul into the meeting. He invited Luke and Aristarchus and Gaius, and Paul came along with them. And so even in that subtle wording, we see something is going on. And so after this, it says, they went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. So all the elders are in agreement, because really what they are doing is they are potentially making it so that they cannot participate in the Pentecost celebration at the temple. Now, I suspect in some ways they're probably hoping that word doesn't get out that this has happened, because they don't want to create an unnecessary disturbance with unbelieving Jews. But they do want the Christian Jews to understand, guys, Gentiles don't make us unclean. Jesus has declared all things clean. And he did so in such a way that his main point was, he declared Gentiles clean. You cannot treat them this way. And so after greeting them, Paul then related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles. Paul's very clear here, and he's also very smart. Paul does not talk about, let me give you a recap of the mission that I've had, the ministry that I've been a part of. No. Paul tells them what God has done. He wants them to know, look what God did here. We can work backwards. Hey, you know, when I was in Ephesus, God raised a young boy from the dead. And then back here in this city, God did this. He shook the entire city and the jail so much so that our chains, Paul and Silas and my chains, fell out, and the whole prison was broken open so that we could walk right out. But we did walk right out because God was working in the heart of a Philippian jailer, and that entire family came to Christ, all because of what God was doing. What's Paul doing? He wants to make it very clear to the Jewish church, guys, the God that you worship, the God that has done wondrous miracles in your midst, the God, you know, of who did wondrous miracles through Jesus that you have witnessed, that you have experienced. Many of these people in the church have been healed by Christ personally. They have seen the power of God. Many of the elders of this church have visibly seen the resurrected Christ. Paul wants them to know, you know, the God that has been demonstrating his power among you, he's been demonstrating his power amongst these Gentile churches as well. So that you know that these churches and your church are a part of the same church. We're one church because we worship the same God, and it's the same God who is working his power in both places. So he recounts all of this power that God is doing. And he makes it clear to them, it's God who's doing it and nobody else. And my page turned. And then he says to them, one by one, the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified God. And they said to him, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. One historian estimated, and this is a very early historian, probably 3rd or 4th century, estimated that at the end of James's life in Jerusalem, during a holiday like Pentecost or during the Passover, when many of the Jews from outside of Jerusalem would come to the temple, that there were as many as 60,000 Jewish Christians. This is no longer a tiny little remnant of Jerusalem. This is the reason why it took so long for them to kill James. James was killed in AD 62. They wanted him dead 30 years before, but they couldn't do it because there were so many Jews in Jerusalem that had embraced Jesus. The idea that Christianity is some Gentile religion is nonsense. It is a Jewish religion. It was started by a Jew amongst Jews, and Jews were the first people that embraced it. And it's from there that Paul will say in Romans chapter 9, we as the Gentiles are grafted into this tree of Christ. And that this has always been a Jewish institution that we become a part of when we put our faith in the Jewish Messiah. Now, granted, there are many Jews that have rejected their Messiah, and they create their own understanding. And so we call that Judaism. It is not Christianity. It's a different religion because they've rejected Jesus as the picture and representative of who the God they worship is. But at this point, James, he's the head of a large Jewish church, and he says, look at how many there are. And because of that, Paul, I need to ask you something. You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. They are all zealous for the law. He doesn't tell us why they're zealous for the law. But I'm going to read between the lines from other parts of Acts and from the gospel itself. These Jewish Christians are not zealous for the law because they think the law will save them. If they were, they have not put their faith in Jesus Christ, and they have not believed the gospel, and neither James nor Paul would refer to them as Christians. They are not zealous for the law to save them, to put them in a right relationship with God. The unbelieving Jew was zealous for the law. Paul talks about it. But their reasons for why they were zealous for the law was to somehow create a right relationship with God. Paul will say in Philippians, I was zealous for the law. Above all others, I was zealous for the law. But he acknowledges it was rubbish. It was a pile of garbage because my zealousness for the law was for the purpose of God accepting me as one of his children. That has been done away with. That was actually never even the case, even in the Old Testament. It was always trusting in the one that God would send, or once he came, the one that God has sent, Jesus Christ. So when James says that this group of Jewish Christians were zealous for the law, we need to stop and say, why were they zealous for the law? In what way were they zealous for the law? What was their motive for being zealous for the law? And here's where I think we have to read between the lines. They were zealous for the law because they knew that if they were not and they just ignored the law within their life, they would not be able to evangelize unbelieving Jews in their communities. They would not be able to evangelize their families. Why is that? Because there's so many things in the law that if they did not zealously try to uphold, that would make them unclean. And therefore, their own families, their own brothers, Jewish brothers and sisters, would not have any relationship with them. They would be treated as Gentiles. And by being treated as Gentiles, they would have no ability to continue to proclaim the gospel to those people. James understood that. Paul understood it. So James and the church recognize, guys, for us to be an evangelistic body in the place that God has put us, we are going to have to be zealous for the law so that we can preach the gospel. Now, I can illustrate this in so many ways that I think makes it easy to see. If I want to be a missionary in a Muslim country, guys, and you see this all the time, if Mary and I went to a Muslim country and we wanted to share Jesus Christ with them, Mary is going to have to wear a hijab. She's going to have to do it. She's going to have to be zealous about doing it. Why? Because she thinks she has to please God? No. She does it because if she doesn't, we cannot impact the people of that culture with the gospel. You can't do it. So this is exactly where the first Jewish Christians were. Okay, we have to maintain a zealousness towards the things of the law, or we will lose our place in this society, in this culture, and we will not be able to proclaim Jesus. And Paul recognizes that. And James recognizes that. Hence, Paul will say, either in 1st or 2nd Corinthians, he says, to the Jew, I become a Jew. That's kind of strange since Paul is a Jew. What does he mean he becomes a Jew? He says, look, when I am trying to reach Jews, I am zealous for the law. I will follow all of the things that will help me be able to maintain my relationship with them. And Luke tells us about this. He tells us that when Paul picks up Timothy in Lystra, and he's going to take Timothy with him as an evangelist to go alongside him, Paul knows that in every town he goes to, the first place he goes is the synagogue, and he begins preaching the gospel there. And now he's got Timothy with him, and Timothy is half Jewish, but he's the right half Jewish for Jews, strangely. His mother is a Jew. And in the first century, unlike the Old Testament, in the first century, it's your mother. If your mother is a Jew, you're a Jew. Because everybody knows who the mother is, they don't necessarily know who the father is. So by the first century, you were Jewish based on your mother, not your father. And his mother and grandmother were Jews. So Timothy's a Jew. So what's Paul do? I know, Timothy, you kind of were raised in a Gentile home and this and that, but Jews are going to see you as a Jew. And if you're going to be of any use to me whatsoever in evangelizing Jews when we come to a community and we go into the synagogue and we want to be a part of that community and we want to preach Jesus, their Messiah, to them, you're going to have to get circumcised. So Timothy gets circumcised. Why? So that he can be a part of the people of God? No, he's already a part of the people of God. He put his faith in Jesus Christ so that he can get God's favor upon his life. Heavens no. God's favor is completely on Timothy's life because God's favor is on his son's life. And Timothy and Jesus have been united by faith. So whatever favor God the Father has towards Jesus, it's now also towards Timothy. He doesn't need to get circumcised for any of those reasons. Why does he get circumcised? So that Jews will listen to him, tell them about their Messiah. That's what's behind this. Now, let's come back a minute and let's talk about where we started. You're starting to see how far these guys would go to reconcile people to the Father. How far did Jesus go? Well, he came down and took on the form of a human being. He was born in a stall, born in slavery to the Roman Empire. He grew up, and every day he willingly laid his life down until he laid it down finally on a cross. All for what? To reconcile us to the Father. What does Paul think he should do? Whatever it takes. If I am in a Jewish community, I will become a Jew. And I will follow all of their little laws, some of them from the Bible, that Jesus has said they have been fulfilled in his coming. Some of them from the Talmud that they have added to the Bible. Paul follows them all. If that's what's necessary for them to hear him, he will have Timothy circumcised, if that's what's necessary. So now he comes to James, and by the way, I think James is thinking the same way. And James is saying, okay, Paul, you have to understand something. Our people are trying to maintain a relationship with their families, with the people they work with the people of this city, so that they can preach Jesus Christ. As a result, they are zealous for the law. But word has come back that you don't care anything about the law. And we need to correct this. They are all zealous for the law, and they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. Is that what Paul teaches? No, it's not. Is it understandable why someone might think he teaches that? Yes, it is. What does Paul teach about circumcision? What he teaches about circumcision of the flesh is, guys, circumcision of the flesh has no value whatsoever unless it leads you to Jesus Christ. In Romans, in two different places, Romans 3 and Romans chapter 9, Paul raises the question, well, if all this is true, then what good is it? What is the benefit of being Jewish, of being an Israelite? And Paul's answer is this: it's a benefit in every way. And then he lists off all of the benefits of being Jewish. He says, one, we are the ones who receive the oracles of God. We've got God's revelation in the Old Testament. Isn't that a benefit? We are the ones that were given the signs of the covenant, circumcision, to remind us of God's promise to us that he would send a seed from Isaac's line, would come one day and he would save us from our sins. We didn't know how, or, you know, we didn't know who, but we knew there was a promise and he would be connected to us through the seed of Isaac and the seed of Abraham. It's a benefit. And he lists all of these things that are a benefit of being Jewish. And we typically stop right there and say, see, Paul thought it was a great benefit to be a Jew. And he lists all these things. What we forget is that Paul kept going. Because where he went with that is, and it is a great benefit because it prepared us to embrace our Messiah when he came, Jesus Christ. However, Paul says, if after all of that you rejected Jesus as the Messiah, then all of those benefits I just listed are no benefits at all. In fact, they will only bring judgment upon you. Circumcision is no benefit at all. It does absolutely nothing for you unless it points you to Jesus. Because it is on our faith in Jesus and embracing Jesus as God's revelation of himself that makes us a part of his true people. Circumcision of the flesh does not do that. It was just the reminder of a promise that God would send someone to do that. So Paul taught this, and it's not surprising that an unbelieving Jew hears this would say, well, Paul is saying that circumcision is worthless. It's useless. And he's saying that the things of the law are useless. Well, yes, from your perspective, I suppose they are, because he is saying that if you don't embrace Jesus Christ, they are useless. They will do you no good at all. In other words, what Paul was saying is, once you reject Jesus, the one that all these promises are pointing towards, the fact that you still believe the promises but not the promised one is going to get you nowhere. It will not get you into a right relationship with God. It will not make you a part of his eschatological community. And so this comes back, and not surprisingly, in Jerusalem, Paul has been branded a particular way. And James is concerned that we've got to at least show them that Paul respects these things, but maybe for a different reason than they think. Paul does not respect pursuing and being zealous for the law as a means of salvation, but he does respect pursuing and being zealous for the law as a means of evangelization. And so James asks him to do something. It seems strange to us. They're all zealous for the law, and they've been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children. In fact, Paul did not tell Jews to not circumcise their children. In fact, he had Timothy circumcised. Paul told Gentiles they didn't need to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. Thus all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but you yourselves also live in observance of the law. This is, I think, James's greatest moment. Some people, like Martin Luther, for example, it's the reason why Martin Luther called James's epistle the Epistle of Straw. I would argue with Martin that he misunderstood what James was saying. He didn't capture something. This is James's greatest brilliance because he recognized, here's what the law requires. Paul, you can't go into the temple if you have come from a Gentile land. If you have come to Jerusalem from a Gentile land, you're not allowed to enter into the temple. You must first go through 1 week of purification before you're allowed to enter into the temple. And every Jew in this city knows it. Paul, if you go into the temple to celebrate Pentecost, there is going to be such an uprising against you and us Christians because they will see what you're doing as a violation of the law. Paul is in a bind. James is in a bind. And here's what the bind is. Well, why can't they go into the temple when they come from a Gentile land? Because they have been with Gentiles, and Gentiles are unclean. And if you've been with unclean people, then you become unclean, and you've got to go through purification. And Paul and James, I think, look at that and say, we got a problem. Because we cannot go through the purification rite to make ourselves clean as an acknowledgement that our presence with Gentiles has made us unclean. We can't do that. We cannot declare to this group of guys that are standing around us in this room that just because they're present with us, we have now become unclean and we can't go into the temple as a result of coming from their houses or eating a Lord's Supper with them. We've been made unclean by eating the Lord's Supper with Gentiles. We're going to make that statement just so that we can go into the temple? But Paul wants to go into the temple and he wants to evangelize. If Paul didn't need to evangelize, I think he would say, well, I just won't go into the temple. It's not that big of a deal to me. But Paul wants to evangelize in the temple, and he wants to go. But he knows if he goes in there, the whole city is going to rise up against him for not keeping the law. And James says, I got an idea, and it's a brilliant idea. We got four guys who've also come back from Gentile lands, and this is what we've been doing for a while. They have taken a Nazarite vow. They don't cut their hair. They don't go near dead people. And one other thing that I can't think. Oh, they don't drink alcohol. Three things. And at the end of that vow, they have to go through 1 week purification as well. But they're going through the purification for a different reason. They're going through it because in their vow, they may have become unclean as a part of keeping that vow. And so they go through the same process of purification because of the vow. Interestingly, remember just a couple chapters ago, Paul cut his hair because of a vow. Paul had taken a Nazarite vow and he had cut his hair. So James said, Paul, this is perfect. You can just join in with them in the vow. Why does he want him to do it? So that you can go through a purification process that doesn't have you declaring that these Gentiles that you're eating with has made you unclean. You can go through the purification process that says, I need to be purified because of the vow that I took. And then we are able to go into the temple because we have been made ceremonially clean. We do not offend the law because we have followed the law. We've had that 1 week. But we also don't offend our convictions, which is Gentiles and eating with Gentiles, especially Gentile Christians around a Gentile table where we celebrate the Lord's Supper, does not make me unclean. And essence, James came up with a brilliant solution for how can we accommodate these unbelieving Jews, make it easier for the thousands of Jewish believers, and at the same time, not violate the absolute principle of our convictions that our Gentile brothers are our brothers and sisters. It's brilliant. It should have worked, but it didn't, because that's how much the Jewish unbelievers hated Paul. But this is why he does it. Now we can make some lessons. You see what he's willing to do? We learn two things here. Paul will go to the most extreme circumstance to accommodate another person's wrong thinking. Let's say it what it is, guys. It's wrong thinking. The Jewish unbelievers have missed the boat in not seeing that Jesus has fulfilled the purpose for all of these things that they continue to do. Their continuance in doing it, thinking that they are maintaining or building a right relationship with God, is wrong thinking. Paul is willing to accommodate that wrong thinking to quite an extent if it gives him the opportunity to try to correct that thinking and share the truth of the gospel with them. But he has a line he will not cross. He will not accommodate wrong thinking to the point where he undercuts the very gospel that he is preaching. He cannot go to the temple and say, I need to be purified because I've been with my Gentile brothers and sisters in Christ and having sharing meals with them and celebrating the Lord's Supper. So I need to purify myself so I can enter this. He can't do it, because that would be a denial of the gospel and what the gospel has done in his life to unite him with these Gentile believers. And he won't do it. And James comes up with a way that he can still be purified, go into the temple, preach the gospel without violating their convictions. It's brilliant. The question I have for us, by the way, as we read next, whenever we get to it, I'm not sure when I'll do it, but when we get to the next passage, you will see that this is part of Paul's defense when he's arrested. Guys, I went through the week of purification. What's your problem? And what do they say? We saw him. He brought a Greek into the temple. Paul didn't bring a Greek into the temple. They had seen Paul with Trophimus in the city earlier in the day. In other words, Paul wasn't about to change his convictions about spending time with his brothers and sisters that were Greek in Christ. They did see him with Trophimus. He was going to do that. He did not bring Trophimus into the temple, though. That was unnecessary. Trophimus is not an advantage to preaching the gospel to the people in the temple. All that would do is get Trophimus killed, and nobody would hear anything that they had to say about the gospel. But he's accused of that. And Paul defends himself by saying, guys, I went through the week of purification. I have a right to be here. And he does get the opportunity to preach. But we come back here and say, what are we to do with this? Guys, we have conflicts everywhere. We have conflicts in our family. We have conflicts with our wives and our husbands. Let's just start there. Pretty basic. I've never met a married couple that don't have some of the most severe conflicts are going to be in our marriages, because there's the most at stake in our marriages. Satan has way more to gain by making conflict in our marriages. So I want you to think about something, whether you're a husband or a wife. What are you willing to do to maintain peace in your marriage? What are you willing to do to bring about reconciliation? What are you willing to accommodate? Well, Jesus and Paul would suggest you should be able to accommodate a whole lot up to the line where you cannot violate your convictions about the gospel and the love of Christ. But let me give you an example for husbands. Husbands, you should be able to surrender an awful lot of things. But you know what the one thing you can't do? You cannot act in such a way just because your wife wants you to that will not be in her best interest, that does not serve her best interest. You can't do that, because that wouldn't be loving. God has this problem all the time. We want him to do this. God, accommodate us. I'm not going to do that, Tom, because it would hurt you. And I love you. So part of love But you know what? God knows always what's in my best interest. I do not always know what's in Mary's. I often think what's in Mary's best interest is really what's in my best interest. So there's a big problem there, but I still would argue we seek to know from God and from communication with our spouse and others, we seek to find out what is in their best interest. And we need to put that interest above ourselves. That's just in a marriage. How about a church? We have conflicts in church all the time. As our church has been growing, we're going to get conflict. Satan is not going to like it. He's going to try to rip it apart. What are you willing to do? Let's take this passage specifically, though. What are we willing to do to maintain the ability to proclaim the gospel to the lost people in our town? That's what's going on here. Paul is willing to make huge sacrifices. Things that he doesn't think he needs to do this at all. He's free of that. He tells us over and over, I have been made free of that. But he surrenders his liberty so that he can maintain the relationship with these people who aren't free so that he can preach the gospel to them. Wow. He does that for the people out there. Are we willing to do it for the people in here? We should be willing to do it for both. And all of this comes back to, it's the right exercise of authority. That's what it means to be a leader. It's what it means to be the head. It's what it means to exercise authority. It is the ability to set aside my own interests, my own rights. Sometimes even what I know is, I don't need to hold on to this truth for the sake of conveying the gospel to someone, for the sake of putting their interests above my own. This is what Jesus has showed us when he came to earth. What God was willing to do to reconcile us to himself. And his Holy Spirit has been working since to conform us into that image. Let's take a little bit of time before we close with a song, and let's just think about things that we need to pray about. Maybe we just need to pray. This is hard to do. It's hard to do in a marriage. Mary and I, we struggle with this all the time, putting the interests of the other one above ourselves. And just like the disciples, I know it. I have this. Remember when I preached through Ephesians? One of the lines that I took right from Paul in Ephesians. Guys, love is not kindness. But it's not just kindness. But it's never less than kindness. It's amazing how many Christians think, okay, I love my spouse. And we look at Christ and we work on, we love them. But we're not kind to them. Paul makes this great statement in chapter 4. No, be kind to one another. Why? Because it's at the foundation of loving one another. You can be kind without truly loving. But you cannot truly love without being kind. It's part of what brings about reconciliation. So what can we be praying for? What can we be lifting up and as we go into this week? But one of the things I'd like us to be thinking about praying for, it's Christmas. Who can we be sharing the gospel with this week?